Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The 52nd Annual Grammy Awards ceremony is slated for January 31st, but one of the awards you might not see presented in the network telecast is the award for Best Classical Album. Among the five nominees in that category is L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, or in English, The Child and the Spells, and Scheherazade, two works by Maurice Ravel as performed by mezzo-soprano Julie Boulian with the Nashville Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Alistair Willis, the Chattanooga Boys Choir, the Chicago Symphony Chorus, and the Nashville Symphony Chorus. And one of the engineers of that recording on the Naxos label is our guest today, John Hill. He's a professor in the MTSU Department of Recording Industry. He earned his master's degree in music from Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario, and his master's in sound recording from McGill University, the Harvard of Montreal. He has been recording engineer for the Nashville Symphony since 2000. Welcome, John. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
If the recording wins the Grammy, will you receive a statuette?
I think I don't get a statuette. I think it actually goes to the symphony folks and the producer, who in this case is Blanton Allspaugh.
The one person I forgot to plug.
There you go.
Yeah. Isn't that awful? But Blanton Allspaugh is the producer of this recording. And we're going to hear a little bit of the CD later in the broadcast. So in addition to the Nashville Symphony, there are some other heavyweights in this category. There are five nominees, including Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony, and James Levine and the Boston Symphony. How does it feel to be in that sort of rarefied air?
It's a great company to be in, I must say. Yeah, I mean, those are some pretty amazing orchestras and, very well-known conductors as well. And as well, great technical teams of people working with those folks. So it's quite an honor.
They don't get the acknowledgement they get unless they have great technical people with them in the recording studio, even though they're superb musicians.
Absolutely.
As is the case with the Nashville Symphony as well.
Yeah, it's totally a team type of thing when you're talking about making a recording. And, of course, the source material is the orchestra molded by whoever is conducting them. But it also takes a solid technical team to put together a recording that's going to be good.
Yeah. Where was this record made? What studios?
We made this at the Skirmerhorn Hall downtown, which at this point was just about brand new. We made the recording for L'Enfant in late, I guess, December of 06, and the hall had just been opened in September of that year. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the first recordings done in the new Symphony Hall, which is quite an amazing venue.
Wow. Is your role strictly post-production, or do you have a role in the actual recording of the music?
No, my role is, particularly in this project, more on the front end, what we call the acquisition phase. So, I'm very much down at the hall doing the front end of the recording.
What does that mean exactly?
Means working with microphones, doing the whole microphone setup, and then being ready so that when the performances are given, we're ready to cut tracks, essentially. So, in this type of setup, there are a lot of different microphones on stage, and we would typically run all of those mics to an individual track of a multi-track recorder. And then later on, you can do editing and post-production mixing and that type of thing.
So you're not involved in the post-production part of it?
Well, sometimes I am. On this particular recording, I did what we would typically call the tracking. So I did the front-end part of the recording.
Okay. Now, with regard to setting up the microphones, do you need specific types or brands of microphones for different types of recording depending upon... Or do you just need, depending upon what kind of musicians and what kind of material you have, or do you just need good professional quality technology?
For this type of thing, I would say it's really the high end of microphone technology. There's a certain class of what we might call studio mics or live recording mics. For making this type of recording, we're really interested in certain specific types of microphones, and they tend to be really expensive, unfortunately. If you're having to buy them.
But, were they already there at the Skirmerhorn, or did you have to bring them into the studios?
No, in this case, most of the microphones used on this recording were my own. On this project, it was sort of a co-production with a company in Boston called Sound Mirror, for whom Blanton works. So some of the mics on that recording were probably from Sound Mirror, and quite a few of them my own.
We know pretty much, just as a layperson looking at photographs, how one mics a vocalist. How does one mic a cello or a contrabassoon or a set of timpani? How do you know where to position the microphone vis-a-vis the instrument and the musician?
It's a great question. And ironically, when you're doing an orchestral recording, you really don't try to get in too close. And this is a primary difference between what we might do in a recording studio on a pop type of recording, where, you know, the main approach is usually to be in very tight to something, what we call close miking. We do some of that with the orchestra, but in fact, with an orchestral recording, you really try to get what we'd call an array of microphones in the front of the orchestra, and the primary stereo pair is usually right behind where the conductor is. So the next time you're up at the symphony and you see, you know, this pair sort of right behind where the conductor is standing, that's the money pair for the orchestra. That's basically where a lot of the sound is being picked up. And then all of the other mics that you see on stage, you know, in the front of the timpani or the cello, for example, are what we call spot mics. And generally the idea is that you're not going to use very much of that in the final mix. You're just going to use a little bit in case you're not getting enough on the mics that are out front.
Because you don't want certain instruments to overwhelm certain other instruments.
Exactly. It's kind of like taking a picture, and some engineers actually will talk about miking in terms of shooting pictures of things. So you, the idea is to have a microphone array out front that gets an overall picture of the orchestra, and then the other mics are kind of used as, you know, sort of like fine etching or fine tuning or bringing something a little more into focus.
Now, it's your responsibility to take care of the mics on the front end. So you're sort of tuning up the technology in the way that the musicians, metaphorically, are tuning themselves up. They're tuning up their instruments before they actually start. You're tuning up the technology before they actually start.
Exactly right. And the idea is that with the multitrack, which is this big recorder that records all of these mics separately, you want to make sure that everything going to that machine is cleanly recorded and well represented, so that later in the mixing phase, when we're in front of a big console or mixer, you know, that we have the best possible ingredients to work with, if you want to think of it like that. So there's parallels not only with, you know, visual technology, but maybe even with cooking. You know, I make a parallel with that quite a bit, that, you know, we're dealing here with ingredients and we want to get the highest possible quality ingredient on the front end of the recipe. So it's sort of, you know, it's kind of a parallel with that.
Now, here in the studio, I'm looking at a board with about 7 or 8 slide pots. Radio people call them pots. They're actually little sliding levers that go up and down and determine volume. Not terribly complicated, the apparatus in front of us here. The console that a recording producer or engineer has in front of him is bigger, has more sliding levers, is more complex, and you're dealing with a couple of choirs, a symphony orchestra, a soloist. How many different slide levers do you have to have on your mixing console in order to make sure that everyone is heard in their proper proportion?
Well, basically, we would want a fader, or as you put it, a slider, for every single microphone that we're recording. So for example, in this piece, which is, as you say, very huge, we've got a big choir, you have soloists, you have a big orchestra, we probably had 30 or 32 microphones on stage, which means each one of those microphones is going to a separate channel of the multitrack recording. And also, when we do what we call a live mix, we have a separate fader or slider for each of those microphones. So for example, at the symphony, they typically perform these pieces on 3 nights. It would be a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. For each of those nights, we're going to acquire tracks for the multitrack, but we're also going to do a live mix because For example, if for radio broadcast, you would want to immediately be able to take something from the studio and play it as a stereo format. So in addition to acquiring the multi-tracks up front, I'm also doing a live mix. So yeah, our consoles tend to be fairly big with a lot of sliders on them. And part of the art of that type of recording is that you're mixing these things together in real time. So you're actually creating the mix as the symphony is playing it. And that's a very old school kind of idea. That's not the way we make recordings now, typically. You know,
it's the way they did it during the big band era, because otherwise with their analog, you know, technology, how else could they possibly have done it?
Exactly. And also where you see it now is in live events for live shows. You know, this is one area where people still have basically one chance to get it right. I mean, the band's going to come on stage, they're going to play it once, and you really have one shot at getting all of this worked out and creating a mix that people in the audience will enjoy. You know, the difference with live sound is that with a lot of the automation and technology that's there now, over a period of nights, you can kind of automate different functions. Mm-hmm. But with the type of thing we're talking about at the symphony, it's really live. It's live to stereo, much as when you're doing this type of interview. If we were doing this live to air, like if we were actually broadcasting this in real time, mm-hmm. it's like that, only now you've got a console with 30 or 32 faders on it, and it's happening once in real time.
Now, so. Guys I've known who run mixing boards at concerts will take Dymo label maker, or some kind of detachable tape, and put to use to identify each of the sliding labels.
Sure.
As to, you know, the guitar comes up here, the drums come up here.
Sure.
Is that what you do with the, I mean, it would sound a little, you know, the Skirmer horn people might not like that, is what I'm trying to say. Or do you just have a sheet numbered 1 to 32 in which you know which microphone pertains to which sliding pot on the board?
Well, we have both. We have what you're referring to, which is a track sheet, and we'd use that from the multi-track so that we know, you know, that channel 1, for example, is the solo violin mic, or channel 10 is the timpani mic. Mm-hmm. But in fact, on our console, we do, and it's very low-tech. I mean, we take a mm-hmm. sticky tape, we put it across there, we take a Sharpie, and we write in above each fader, you know, what's on that fader. And
yeah.
And it's really crucial because, again, you know, the pieces are being performed in real time, and some of this music has some very intricate stuff going on, you know, like you may have a contrabassoon solo that lasts one bar in one piece.
Right.
So you have to know exactly where that is. And part of your job as a mixer is that when that thing happens, you have to know that at that moment, that fader has to be brought up, because otherwise, when it's on the radio, no one will hear that contrabassoon and that was the solo. So,
Of course, the conductor is going to want the musicians to do retakes if something does not sound quite right to his ear.
If a
trumpet sounds as though it's just being played, going through the motions instead of being played with emotion, or a violin doesn't sound as though it's being played with the proper level of expressiveness, because these instruments and these singers are playing characters in
mm-hmm.
this opera, and much like in Peter and the Wolf, they have to personify the character that they're playing.
Very much so. And let's not forget just good old human
screw-ups,
exactly. I didn't want to, you know, but let's face it, you know, you can be the best brass player in the world, and occasionally you cack, you know, you squash a note, it comes
mm-hmm.
out badly. Not the brass players in particular, but,
yeah.
You know, that happens. And in fact, for the recording, we would edit around those things. I mean, if you liked the take from Friday night, except, let's say, there was one squeak, you know, in the violin section, or, and this has happened many times, actually, at the Skirmer horn, someone coughs, they have whooping cough, and they make it onto the recording. Obviously, if you're going to put that out as a CD, you're going to have to edit around that.
Yeah.
We've even had cases where, you know, somebody pushes over a little table that's there for refreshments, you know, in the auditorium. And you definitely hear that when all the microphones are up. So editing can be a lot of fun in post-production.
Let's take a listen to a little bit of it now. L'Enfant et le Serlège by Maurice Ravel. And the soloist here is Julie Bourlian. And we'll hear just a little bit of this track right now. Particular story line comes from Colette, who I believe is the same French woman who wrote Gigi, the book for Gigi, anyway, on which Gigi is based. And in this story, this little girl, who, believe it or not, Julie was just singing as, is tearing up everything in her room. She's tearing up her things, and she's totally incorrigible, and all of a sudden, the things start coming to life, and little animals start coming to life and start teaching her a lesson about her destructiveness and how terrible it is. And I won't spoil the ending for you, but it's a very poignant kind of ending. And you have different individuals and the soloist, vocalist, and musicians playing these characters that interact with the little girl, and finally, as she learns her lesson, she goes back to Mama, and she goes back to the security of Mama and realizes how sorry she is for what she's done.
Yeah, the sort of life lesson here for toddlers or small children is, you know, be careful about misbehaving, because the whole room may come to life and turn into like a bad Timothy Leary experiment or something. But
I mean,
phantasmagoria was really part of what Ravel referred to, you know, in this work, this sort of dream state and inanimate objects all of a sudden having personalities of their own and coming to life and teaching the child a lesson, essentially.
Yeah. So. You alluded earlier to the fact that you have everybody in the studio at the same time. It's sort of old school in that respect. It back in the days of yore, Frank Sinatra would record with a full orchestra and
sure.
Nelson Riddle's arrangements, and Nelson would be in there
right.
helping him out, and they'd kibitz and collaborate and whatever. But a lot is made of the use of laying down tracks and various techniques that you don't require musicians and singers to even be in the same state anymore, let alone in the same studio. As a matter of fact, both Sinatra did a duets album that way in the later part of his career. I think Tony Bennett's had his duet partners in the studio with him in a lot of cases. It really needs to be different, though, with a classical recording. Can you imagine doing a classical recording, doing one part here, another part here, another part here, and then putting it together like a mosaic?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be the standard technique. I mean, what we're doing here is, as you say, quite old school in the sense that everyone is in one room and performing at one time. But, you know, the technology now is pretty amazing, and depending what kind of project you're working on, there are a lot of possibilities. You know, we did another work with the CD a little while back for the observatory up in town, and they did a show called Stars, and in that one, the composer, who was from Britain, came here to record the basic tracks with the symphony and then took that back to his studio in London and basically did his own post-production and his own manipulation of it. There's nothing I've worked on with the symphony where we have different people in different towns collaborating in real time yet, but it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility, and the technology already exists to do things like that. So it's just that the nature of a classical recording is a little more that everyone's going to be in one place at one time performing this. And then with us, really, the editing possibility comes into play because we have different performances on different evenings that we can intercut right. between.
Is that a style of recording, putting it all together instead of doing pieces in different places, instead of doing it all at once? Is that the new style of recording something that classical artists would be amenable to, or is it something that they'd put an argument up against, or do they care as long as they get the best possible sound overall?
I think it would sort of depend what the project is and who's doing it. You know, earlier in that particular year, we did a premiere, a hall opening concert, and Bela Fleck and Edgar Meyer were involved in that, and for example, they were very interested in taking some of these tracks home to their own studios so that they could experiment with doing different things with it. At the end of the day, you know, we ended up using all of the tracks from the actual recordings that we made at the Skirmerhorn. But the possibility certainly exists, and you know, the sky's the limit these days. Really, it's whatever you want to do with your particular artistic vision. I mean, the technology is basically here to serve that.
When you hear the various elements of the music, do you consider yourself sort of an artist of a sort, exercising your own musical judgment, or are you working strictly at the direction of the producer?
Wow, that's a good one. Well, I guess it's a little bit of both. I mean, certainly on a project like this, the producer and the conductor have a certain relationship which is built around the music and the artistic vision of the piece. On the other hand, what ends up being released to the public, and every time you play a fixed product like a CD, is definitely, at least in part, the artistic vision of the people who are the technologists, you know, the recordists and the mixing engineers. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's a little bit of both. In my own case, you know, my background is heavily music-oriented. So I really consider myself a musician who has, you know, a set of technical skills to draw on.
I ask the question because the lay people like me might consider a technician to be just a guy who does a lot of knob and
right.
dial twirling, but
right.
you have a master's in music, and it's obvious from the way that you speak that you obviously know the piece, you feel the piece, and I was wondering if that was essential to a technician's sense of professionalism, what he brings to his work.
I think it is, particularly for this gig, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. You know, for this type of work, you would definitely not want to have somebody who is just fiddling with knobs, mm-hmm. knob tweaking, because that really, you know, for this type of work, one really has to have some sort of working knowledge of music. And certainly when you start editing these things together. I mean, I'm working from a score, from mm-hmm. a full orchestral score that typically the composer and or the conductor have marked up. So for that type of work, you know, one needs to be able to read music, obviously. And then the second part of it is once you create an edit, you have to be able to listen to that and evaluate, well, did that work or did it not work? And in the case of music editing, the final litmus test is, can you hear the edit or not? And if you can hear the edit, it means it didn't work. Mm-hmm. So, again, there's a certain level of music knowledge and ear that kind of has to be there in order, you know, you have to bring that skill set mm-hmm. to the table. And I would think that that's one of the reasons that I would be hired for that kind of work.
I have an old Benny Goodman 33 and a third that was made in the, like, 60s or seven, late 60s, early 70s, with just him and a little sextet or septet. And there are some places in there where you can actually hear Benny take a breath
right
before he blows on his clarinet.
Right.
do classical recordings, how do you feel as a technician when you hear someone who has to use his mouth to play his instrument breathe? Is that something
right.
you want to exclude from the recording, if at all possible?
That's one of those things, you know, some people would call that an extraneous noise, you know, similar to if you have a clarinet and you hear the key clicks on the pads, or sometimes if you hear an acoustic guitar, when people are moving the chords, you'll hear this little, know, with the strings.
I hear that a lot.
Right. And on the one hand, the one philosophy would say, well, that's part of the sound that the musician made, so, you know, it's fine for that to be in there. For me personally, there's a sort of threshold that you come to, and unfortunately, some of the technology that we use actually makes this a little bit of a problem, because, for example, with compression, certain devices called compressors and limiters, and they tend to bring up those low-level details. So all of a sudden, what you didn't notice before becomes this huge thing, and you're going, oh, gosh, you know, get that out of the recording. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that can happen with breath noises, as you were saying. On the other hand, you know, there were some records from the late 80s where, and I won't name the artists or the producers, but at that time, you know, digital technology was becoming popular, and I can think of one very well-known vocalist where in the post-production phase, they went in and they actually removed all of this vocalist's breath noises. So instead of hearing the, you know, before the phrase, all of that got taken out.
Yeah.
And so you hear all of a sudden this vocalist come in full bore at the beginning of phrases without anything before it to sort of cue you. And it's the most weird sounding thing ever, because you're going, well, that, you know, that never existed in nature like that.
Yeah.
So long story short, that's one of those things that is an artistic call. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it might be that you do a mix of something like that and you hand it to the producer and they say, well, you know, at 4 minutes, 13 seconds, I hear this huge breath noise. Can you either take that out, or can you, nowadays in the digital stuff, in the digital domain, we have the ability to just drop the gain digitally on something.
Right.
So if it's really a noticeable thing that's going to tweak some people, you can just maybe bring that down 10 dB and then it's still there, but it's not in your face and you can kind of live with it a little bit better.
Are there any particular challenges in blending in a recording children's voices with adult voices? You had some kids singing in here.
Yeah, very tricky. And I've actually done a few albums with the Nashville Children's Choir, and so I had a bit of experience with that coming into this. But the thing with children's voices is that because they're not mature, you know, they just don't project. So for a recording, you tend to have to get into fairly tight with them, with the microphones, so that, again, when you're remixing it or live mixing it, that you have them to work with. This piece is very tricky because on the one hand, you have, to begin with, a big orchestra that's capable of making big sounds. Then you have a number of soloists, maybe three, four different soloists appearing at one time. You have a children's choir, and you have a full adult choir. So balancing all those elements against each other can be a, you know, significant thing.
Yeah.
And in this piece, we actually did, as I say, three live performances before we did the recording sessions. So another challenge there was that for the live performances, this was actually a semi-staged opera event.
Right.
So there was a platform and people had costumes and there was lighting and some level of props. Then after the live performances, we had about 8 hours to basically tear everything down off the stage and create the setup for the recording. And obviously in the recording, you know, we're not going to do costumes and stuff like that.
Right.
So in terms of miking it, you know, you would approach it very differently for the recording than you would for the live show, which is intended more for an audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's listen to another track off the CD right now. This is Scheherazade by Ravel.
Thank you.
As the music reaches a dramatic crescendo, we fade down. Keeping everything in balance, especially when the music goes from rather moderate to a rather dramatic crescendo, whether it's the symphony doing it or whether it is the soloists doing it, and opera is, after all, an art form full of passion.
Exactly.
You could go from high to low or low to high in a very abrupt way instead
right.
of gradually.
Right.
That's got to take some degree of real sensitivity on your part in order to make sure not only that there's no distortion, which is obvious enough in and of itself, but also to make sure that everything, every segment, every part of it is in proportion.
Yeah. Yeah, it helps if it's not your first rodeo.
Yeah.
Because, as I was saying before,
it's a juggling act.
It really is. And on this type of situation, it's all about the front end work. It's all about doing your homework before the event. Because obviously, when the orchestra comes out on the Thursday night for that first performance, they're going to come and play. And you have to be completely ready. I mean, obviously, you can't run out in the middle of the first piece and say, oh, hold on, I didn't place that microphone correctly, or I have to hook something. You can't do that. So it really is doing your homework with the music, knowing what you're going to be faced with up front, and then careful planning and good execution.
The Grammy Awards are scheduled, as we said, for January 31st. They usually do the classical awards in a pregame ceremony,
right.
as it were. But they mention the winners of the classical awards during the more pop-oriented telecast. So look for the name of the Nashville Symphony Orchestra. Look for L'Enfant et le Sortilège, Scheherazade, by Maurice Ravel, and I don't know if you'll see John Hill's name there, but you'll hear his work, you'll hear a bit of his work, and know that he is one of the behind the scenes people who made the Nashville Symphony Orchestra sound as good as it does. Thank you for being with us today, John.
Thanks for having me.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. You can catch the podcast at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.